White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and
I am Hadding Scott.
And it is April 11th already, and a beautiful April 11th where I am, and so I can understand why we don't have too many people listening to us live, Hadding, because it's sunny and lovely out, and people probably have a lot of things to do, even if it's just being outdoors and in their yard. But maybe we'll gain a few more as we go along. Doesn't matter too much. Because we have a terrific show tonight, though. And I know it's going to have a lot of listeners eventually. As we speak right now, Elie Wiesel is also speaking at Kent State University. He's in a different time zone, so he started an hour ago. But
That's why we don't have the listeners. They're all listening to Elie
Wiesel. Oh, that's it. They've all gone up there. Get a ticket and go out there, yeah. But the difference between what we're going to say and what he says is like night and day, and we'll be speaking truth and he's telling lies. But I had to mention that because I've been, you know, watching that and paying attention to it. So this is the day, this is the night that he's doing that. But tonight we're beginning chapter 38, and it is a powerful chapter. In my opinion, I keep saying that, but they keep getting better and better. This is titled, Taft Once Tried to Resist Jews and Failed. It contains a lot of lessons, I think, for us. Do you think so, Hadding?
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, and for people who don't know, you know, I thought there's a lot of people, well, young people, they don't know who William Howard Taft is. And I don't know that much about him myself, but he was the 27th president of the United States. Excuse me. He was president between 1909 and 1913. So who came after him? Woodrow Wilson. And you know what happened in 1913. Terrible. So I guess he didn't do anything to prevent it. But he was a Republican, and he later became the 10th Chief Justice of the United States. So that's what he really wanted to do. And he's the only person who served in both as president and as chief justice of the Supreme Court. And that's all I have to say about him. But I will say that this chapter fully supports what I talked about last Saturday afternoon, which is just not less than a week ago. And, you know, I get really turned on about my theme that we cannot keep the Jews from power and influence as long as they're free to operate in our country. And I think what we're going to read in this chapter is absolutely
I'll just add
shows
that,
that gap.
The Jews got Taft in that 1912 election. There had not been a Democrat president in quite some time when Wilson got elected in 1912. But the way they managed it was that Theodore Roosevelt ran against Taft as a bull moose.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the Roosevelts have some Jewish ancestry. Mm-hmm. And Theodore Roosevelt was also the first president to have a Jew on his cabinet that anybody knows was a Jew. And Theodore Roosevelt ran against Taft in 1912, and that threw the election to Woodrow Wilson.
In the same party. Yeah, because he started this progressive party in the Republican Party, and Taft was a more conservative Republican. And so there was a rift there. And Teddy Roosevelt, of course, was very popular, and Taft is portrayed as being not a very good campaigner and doesn't have that kind of appeal to people, but he was, you know, a solid man, and anyway, he did his best, but he lost terribly in that election because of Teddy Roosevelt, like you say. So, and that Jewish connection with Roosevelt, yeah, well, the Jews were out for Taft, and that's what we're going to find out in this chapter. It's really interesting. And I want to say that, as I've already agreed with Hadding, this is a long chapter. And the next, our next chapter is a quite a short one. And I want to talk about something before we get started on this that came up that I think is also points out that, you know, is connected with what we've been reading here. And so we're going to take a little time now to discuss this story, and before we get started reading the chapter, but then we will be able to finish next week this chapter and the following chapter with no problem, as far as I can see. So this is a story that came out, I think this court case took place last week. It was in the employment court in Britain, but it was in which it was brought by a Jew, a charge of anti-Semitism to the University and College Union. It was a big organization in Britain with all the academics involved in it, and they, of course, have been very big in promoting boycotting of Israel because of, you know, its crimes and its treatment of Palestinians and all that usual stuff. And they want to boycott, they want to get Israel to behave better through boycotting not only products, but not inviting their academic people to Britain's academic institutions, things like that. Well, of course, you know, the Israelis, so then they have to work off hard against this. And so there's a private citizen in by the name of Ronnie Fraser in Britain who has started a he calls it the Academic Friends of Israel. He started this organization and he brought this court case, and all the British organizations, I mean all the Jewish organizations in Britain, you know, lined up behind him. And they thought they had this fantastic case. And they had this great attorney, Jewish attorney, Anthony Julius, running the thing. There was other attorneys there. And it was a big, big deal. But boy, the tribunal really rejected what they offered big time and told him why. And what they wanted is just absolutely outrageous. So I've been rattling on here. Do you want to add anything about it before I make a few points before we go on?
Well, in a way, this is the Jews' own troublemaking coming back to bite them in the butt, because there was all this boycotting against South Africa in the 70s and 80s and 90s. And, you know, on the same principles, the state of Israel ought to be boycotted.
Well, sure, it should be. Right. But, of course, they're gonna do everything they can to fight it. Now, this thing is all based around anti-Semitism, naturally, and what Ronnie Fraser and his legal team there brought forth, basically, was that Jews possess a strong feeling of affinity toward Israel that is an intrinsic part of their Jewish identity. And therefore, you know, if you attack Israel in any way, that's practicing anti-Semitism against ordinary Jews who have this intrinsic part of their identity being pro-Israel, you know? And this is really outrageous. So they said, but the tribunal, one of the main things that they said was, a belief in the Zionist project or an attachment to Israel or any similar sentiment cannot amount to a protected characteristic. It is not intrinsically a part of Jewishness. So that's... Uh-huh. But it came down, and they also excoriated them for even bringing this case, and said they were in essence wasting everybody's time with it, you know, and a few other things like that. But now this Ronnie Fraser, after it's all over, a lot of the Jewish groups said, well, we didn't think this had much of a chance. You know how they do. If they were going to win, they're all there ready to, you know, celebrate. But since they lost so bad, they said, well, we didn't think this was a very good idea to begin with. But Fraser said that he was not going to give up, and he called upon the leadership of British Jewry. And you know how Jewish Britain is already. I mean, God. But he wants to take it further. He wants British Jewry to establish a definition of anti-Semitism that includes belief in Zionism and an attachment to Israel. And he says this should amount to a protected right of Jews. Now, that just makes me want to, you know, scream and yell and go out and strangle people, because this is so beyond the pale. You know, these people, well, we've been talking in these international Jew chapters about how they're pushing. They push, push, push. And you're going to see a lot of pushing in tonight's chapter. And, you know, when they lose, they just start, they just keep going. They never lose in their own mind. They just have, you know, have to keep working at it for a while longer. And so now they're trying to get this protected right of Jews in a very Jew-friendly nation like Britain that doesn't want to be anti-Semitic at all and say that, you know, that Jews have this. This is something that Jews have and should be protected. It has to be protected in the land where they live. They're living in Britain. They think they're totally, you know, have every right to be there. And they're pushing these rights that they need to be protected from any kind of criticism about Israel or Zionism, because that's that makes them feel bad, I guess. You know, it goes against what is their Jewish identity. This is so awful. It's so awful. And it just shows, you know, how far that they will never stop. They never stop. They are never satisfied. They will push, push, push. That's their nature. And there's something in here about a pushy Jew. Oh, yeah, one of the witnesses for this Ronnie Fraser's case was another Jew, of course, who said that when he went to attend a meeting at the UCU, the, you know, University College Union, that he was told that he was a pushy Jew. And I don't know what they didn't give any of the particulars in this article. But that was his complaint, and they didn't go for that either. In fact, they really went to the tribunal. I think there was three judges there. They really came out against him, too, saying, you know, you have no business. You know, if you want to be a political activist, you've got to accept the things that go along with it. You can't have your feelings, you know, protected all the time. That's another one of those things you can't say to a Jew, even though they're as pushy as all get out. But you can't say it because that's a stereotype. In anti-Semitic. So, I guess this was in Haaretz, Haaretz. If people want to read it, Haaretz.com, Jewish World. No, that's it. British Jewry in Turmoil After Tribunal Blasts Pro-Israel Activists for Bringing Harassment Case. So if you want to look up something like that, you should be able to find it. Pretty interesting, but also it's good they lost, but it's also kind of scary because, you know, I have a real horror of Jewish rule, really real Jewish rule, which we haven't seen yet. I just have a horror of it. So I read stuff like that, and I'm just up in arms over it. I think people should be aware of what they're trying to do.
Okay.
All right, I'm done. You want to start?
All right. Taft once tried to resist Jews and failed. William Howard Taft is an amiable gentleman. There is so much to agree with in the world that he seldom finds it possible to disagree with anything. It is a very comfortable attitude for one to assume, but it doesn't push the world along. Real harmony is wrung out of discord by laboring against disagreeable facts. It is not achieved by mere pit-pats on the back of untoward conditions. There is no doubt that had one approached William Howard Taft a year ago and said, "Mr. Taft, you know there are evil forces in the world which ought to be resisted," he would have replied, "Certainly, by all means." If one had said, "Mr. Taft, some of this evil is just ignorant inclination, which can be dealt with by various means of enlightenment, but some of it represents a deliberate philosophy which has gathered about itself a definite organization for action," he would have responded, "I'm afraid it is true." And then had one said, Mr. Taft, the people should be made aware of this, given a key to it, that they may keep their eyes open and learn the meaning of certain tendencies that have puzzled them," he would in all likelihood have replied, "I believe in enlightening the public mind that it may take care of itself." Suppose you had added, "Mr. Taft, if you found a written program setting forth the steps to be taken to fasten a certain control on society, And if on looking about you observed a definite act of set of tendencies which seemed to parallel the program at every point, would it appear to you significant? Mr. Taft would, of course, answer yes. There is no other answer to make. No other answer has been made by anyone who has compared the two things. I don't quite agree with that, but...
Well, I do, but... They're never going to forget about the protocols. That's the guiding light of what they're doing here, and probably why they're doing it.
Shouldn't be, but
well,
okay.
but it is, because it opened their eyes and they thought, my God, we've got to do something. So it had a good effect. I think we should also tell people, in case anybody doesn't know and doesn't look up Taft, that he was quite a portly gentleman. And
yes,
but he carried it pretty well until he
got
quite a bit older.
There was a story about him getting stuck in the bathtub.
Oh, I know. It was always. That's the only thing I ever remembered about him.
Yeah.
And he's the president that got stuck in the bathtub, but I don't know.
I don't know how they got him out.
I just pulled him. I don't know. Put some Vaseline or dribbled some chicken grease down along the sides.
Okay. If Mr. Taft had been approached first on that side of the question, he would have uttered words very valuable to those who would attach value to his words. But what has Mr. Taft's testimonial to do with either side of the case? Does his support strengthen it, or does his opposition weaken it? If it came to a battle of names, the Dearborn Independent could present a very imposing list of men who acknowledge the importance of the studies being made, and who agree with most of the observations presented. But such a list would add nothing to the facts in the case, and facts must stand on their own foundation regardless of the attitude of Mr. Taft, or even Mr. Arthur Brisbane.
Yeah, and we did a whole program on Arthur Brisbane, one of the chapters.
But there is a very interesting story about Mr. Taft and the Jews. Mr. Taft knows it and can verify it. A number of American Jews also know it, and it may perhaps be useful to tell it now. However, that we may not seem too desirous of evading Mr. Taft's latest defense of the Jews, we shall begin with that. Unduly stirred by this series of studies, the leading Jews of the United States indicated by their perturbation that the truth in these articles made it impossible to ignore them. Perhaps as many people have been inclined toward agreement with the articles by the attitude of the Jews themselves as by the statements made in the articles. Jewish defense has been made with great formality and show of authority, but without the hoped-for effect. The Jews of the United States, evidently finding that their own statements have failed to carry, are making a wholesale conscription of Gentiles for purposes of defense. As in Russia, the Gentiles are being pushed into the firing lines. Mr. Taft was therefore approached with a proposition. That was some time ago, probably about November 1st. Now, according to Mr. Taft's own signed statement made on November 1st, he had not even read the Dearborn Independence articles, but was taking the Jews' word for their character and contents. And yet, on December 23rd, we find Mr. Taft in Chicago at the LaSalle Hotel, delivering an oration before the B'nai B'rith, uttering his statements with all the finality of a man who had made a deep study of the Jewish question, and had at last attained a mature conclusion.
Well, when was this again? When was this happening? What's the date we're dealing with here? Is this after he was president?
Well, I believe this article's from 1921, so we're talking about years after he was president.
Talking about current time. Okay.
But he was still influential and involved in politics. His name was on the list of supporters of the League to Enforce Peace in 1918, which is the earliest document that I ever found that contained the term New World Order. It was something published by the League to Enforce Peace.
Yeah, I think I had said that he was Chief Justice from 1921 to 1930. So there was a kind of a from 1913 to 1921, he was doing other things, whatever, but he was, yeah, like you say, he was visible and influential. And so he had a long career. All right.
On November 1st, I guess this is 1920, on November 1st, Mr. Taft wrote to a New York Jew deprecating these articles as a foolish pronouncement which I understand has been issued through the Dearborn Independent. The expression, which I understand, is equivalent in ordinary speech to which I have heard. He had not read them. He was taking hearsay on which to base his opinion. There are signs that he had not read them even at the time of his speech in Chicago, for he did not so much as allude to one of the startling parallels which have weighed on the minds of many important men in this country. The Jews wanted Mr. Taft's name. They wanted a Gentile front, and they got it. The speech contributes nothing to the discussion. It proves nothing. It disproves nothing. In parts, it is a rehash of a speech delivered by a New York rabbi. Indeed, one of William Howard Taft's most telling points was the almost verbal repetition of a point made by that rabbi. Mr. Taft's business now is the delivery of addresses. Between November 1st, at which time he had not read the Jewish question at all, until December 23rd, when he presumed to pronounce judgment on it for all time, he had been away a great deal on the road. Indeed, he reached Chicago without having done any of his Christmas shopping. He explained that he had been traveling all over the country so fast that his time had all been taken up. When he found time to study the Jewish question does not appear. When he found time to study the Jewish question does not appear. That's strangely worded. It is most probable that he had no time and did no studying. If he did, he carefully concealed the fruits of it when delivering his address. Before his address was delivered, the newspapers had announced that it was to be made against anti-Semitism, and this series of articles was specified. It was apparently foreknown, therefore, that not a judicial pronouncement was to be expected from Mr. Taft, but a partisan plea. The newspapers indicate that Mr. Taft had not even dictated his speech until he reached Chicago. The material he had at hand during his dictation was the printed propaganda with which the Jews have been flooding the country. Taft's speech reeks with it. There isn't an original idea in it. He was the human megaphone whom the Jews retained for one night through whom to voice their words. The real purpose of the speech was, of course, to secure its publication throughout the country as the voice of the people on the question. The voice of the people on the question. But nothing whatever excuses the fact that the speech contains absolutely no contribution to the question. Mr. Taft is against religious prejudice. So is everybody else. Mr. Taft is against racial prejudice. So is everybody else. Mr. Taft wants concord and goodwill. So does everybody else. But what have these to do with the facts which comprise the Jewish question? The real story of Mr. Taft and the Jews begins back in the time when Mr. Taft lived in the White House. The Jews maintain a lobby in Washington whose business it is to know every president and every prospective president, and, of course, he was made president, but whether they did not foresee his political future or whether they considered his opinions as having too little force for them to bother about is not clear, but the fact seems to be that very little fuss was made about him. There are no indications that he ran after the Jews or the Jews after him in the days before his presidency.
What's interesting that they say the Jews maintain a lobby in Washington whose business it is to know every president and every prospective president. That might have been B'nai B'rith at that time, and just the whole general bunch of Jews. I don't know if they, we talk now about the AIPAC lobby, but didn't have that then. But they did have one.
As president, Mr. Taft once stood out against the Jews, was strongly denounced as unfavorable to the Jews, was soundly beaten by the Jews in a matter on which he had taken a firm stand, and has ever since shown that he has learned his lesson by accommodating the Jews in their desires. The story involves a portion of that voluminous history which consists of the quarrels between the United States and other nations on account of the Jews. Readers interested in this phase of the history of the United States can find it fully set out by Jewish writers. There seems to be a certain pride taken in recounting the number of times the nations have been compelled to give diplomatic recognition to the Jewish question. From 1840 until 1911, the United States had special diplomatic trouble concerning the Jews. From 1840 until 1911.
Yeah, they say there's a voluminous, I really like this first sentence of this paragraph, a voluminous history which consists of quarrels between the United States and other nations on account of the Jews. You know, and that's what we're totally been practically destroyed with now, you know, that the, you know, we can't get along with anybody because of the Jews.
Yeah. Multi-trillion dollar wars also.
Yeah.
The trouble that culminated during 1911, in an unparalleled act by the United States, involved William Howard Taft, who was then president. For centuries, Russia has had her own troubles with the Jews, and as the world knows, has at last fallen prostrate before the Jewish power, which for centuries has been working to undermine her. Even Disraeli was not blinded to the fact that Jews had a control over Russia, which the rest of the world never knew. The biggest hoax in modern times was the propaganda against Russia as the persecutor of the Jews. Russia devoted to the Jews a large part of the most favored section of the land, and was always so lax in those laws which prohibited Jews from settling in other parts of the country that the Jew was able to create an underground system throughout the whole of Russia which controlled the grain trade, controlled public opinion, and utterly baffled the Tsar's government. The cry of persecution arose because the Jews were not permitted to exploit the peasants as much as they desired. They have, however, gained that privilege since.
Well, let me say here that this is, this is just another example of how, now, they're talking about this Pale of Settlement, I suppose, is the best, you know, right. Good, nice portion with good land and everything. But the Jews have presented that as persecution, as you just said, you know, that they were forced to be there. Well, that, you know, but the thing is that they had a good deal there, but they took advantage and they continued to operate illegally, you know, through their underground system and cause a lot of trouble for the Tsar's government. And this is why, you know, as long as they're around, people say, well, if we put some restrictions on them, you can't restrict these people. I mean, nobody has ever succeeded in doing it, as far as I know.
Yeah.
There's only one thing, and that's expulsion, and then where do you expel them to? And, you know, that they're not going to still be, especially in today's world, still be causing trouble.
This is a huge problem. Especially if your criterion is religion, it becomes very easy for Jews to evade restrictions because they just undergo baptism. Yeah, and they've got their Kol Nidre prayer, which annuls it in advance. So,
yeah, I mean, they have everything set up, or they'd set it up if they don't, to get away, to never, ever have to be you know, to never go along with whatever restrictions or limitations you put on them.
Now, when the United States appeared as the New Jerusalem, its Jewish citizens conceived the idea of using the American government to achieve for the Jews what other means had failed to achieve. Russian and German Jews would come to the United States, become naturalized as quickly as possible, and go back to Russia as Americans to engage in trade. Russia knew them as Jews and held them to be subject to the laws relating to Jews. Protest after protest reached the State Department as more and more German or Russian Jews went back to Russia to circumvent the Russian laws. At first, the matter was not serious because it was shown, in many cases, that these naturalized Americans did not intend to return to the United States at all, but had acquired American citizenship solely as a business asset in Russia. In these cases, of course, the United States did not feel obligated to bestir herself.
So what's happening here? So these Russian and German Jews are coming to the United States, becoming American citizens, and then going back as Americans, which gave them an advantage.
Yeah.
Okay.
The time came, however, when American ministers to Russia were requested to look into the situation. Their reports are accessible. John W. Foster was one of these ministers, and he reported in 1880 that Russia would be glad to give liberal treatment to bona fide American citizens, not disguised German Jews.
Bona fide.
Yeah, in Latin, though, it's bona fide.
Well, we're not speaking Latin.
Well, you know, it kind of grates on my ears the way people pronounce Latin terms in a legal context, like...
Well, it would to you, because you know Latin. But I've heard all my life bona fide in...
Yeah, I know.
You know.
It's bona fide.
Okay.
Anyway.
Okay.
Sine die, they say, sine die.
Well, I don't know that one.
Sine die means they...
I don't know that.
Means they won't wait to vote on the proposal.
Well, bona fide, though, is a very common word.
Yeah, bona fide.
Yeah, all right.
During all this time, the Russian question was being sedulously propagated in the United States. It appeared first in the aspect of the Russian persecutions. The Jews represented that their life in Russia was a hell. John W. Foster, later Secretary of State, father-in-law of John Lansing, the recent resigned...
Robert Lansing.
Okay, I'm not sure what I said there. Father-in-law of Robert Lansing, the recently resigned Secretary of State under President Wilson, was at that time representing the United States in Russia, and he reported as follows on the status of the Russian Jews. In all the cities of Russia, the number of Jewish residents will be found more or less in excess of the police registry, and greater than the strict interpretation of the law authorizes. For instance, persons who have given the subject close attention estimate the number of Jewish residents in St. Petersburg at 30,000, while it is stated the number registered by the police authorities is 1,500. From the same source, I learned that while only one Hebrew school is registered by the police, there are between 3,000 and 4,000 children in unauthorized Jewish schools of this capital. As another indication of the extent of Jewish influence, it is worthy of note that one or more Jewish editors or writers are said to be employed on the leading newspapers of St. Petersburg and Moscow, almost without exception.
So, saying that there's a lot more Jews there than they admit.
I've heard Ernst Sundel say that about Germany also, that there were a lot more Jews there than official figures would indicate. At every turn, the United States government discovered that the Jews were exaggerating their difficulties for the purpose of forcing government action. presently, after years of underground work and open propaganda against Russia in the daily press, until the American conception of Russia was fixed almost beyond correction, the agitation took the form of the Russian passport question. Russia dares to flout an American passport. Russia insults the government of the United States. Russia degrades American citizens. And so forth and so on. Jews in the United States demanded nothing less than the United States break all treaty relations with Russia. They demanded it. James G. Blaine desired one thing more than another, which was this, that something, anything, be done to block the flood of Jewish immigration then beginning to flood the country. The hospitality of a nation should not be turned into a burden, he wrote.
So James Blaine was a patriot, you know, looking out for the interests of the United States at that time.
Yeah.
Correct?
There was then the strange situation of the United States itself making complaints about the Jews, and at the same time being asked to question Russia's rights to handle similar complaints in her own domain. The Minister of Foreign Affairs for Russia appreciated this point, and when the American minister told him that 200,000 Jews had emigrated to the United States from Russia, he rejoined, "If such a number of people had gone to the United States..." This is the Russian, isn't it?
Well, the Minister of Foreign Affairs for Russia, yes.
Yeah.
Minister
of Foreign "If such a number of people had gone to the United States as workers to aid in developing the country, he supposed they would be acceptable. But if they went to exploit the American people, he could understand how objectionable it was."
Well, I think that's somebody quoting him. But
evidently.
Anyway.
Oh, well.
Yeah. Okay.
Of course, the whole point with Russia was that the Jews were exploiting her. They were milking Russia, not feeding her.
No.
If space permitted, much rich material could be presented here. The attitude of the American statesmen of 25 to 40 years ago on questions of immigration and racial propaganda was eminently wise and sound. So until the days of William Howard Taft, this Jewish propaganda continued, always aimed at Russia, always planning to use the United States as the club with which to strike the blow. It must be borne in mind at all times that the Jews maintain a lobby at Washington, a sort of embassy from the Jewish nation to the government of the United States, and this lobby is in the hands of a principal ambassador. It was, of course, this ambassador's business to get hold of President Taft as firmly as possible. But President Taft was not at that time so easy as the people have since been taught to regard him. There was a commercial treaty between Russia and the United States, and it had existed since 1832, and President Taft behaved as if he thought the Jewish demand that the treaty be broken was rather too much. The Jewish demand was that the United States denounce a treaty which had existed between the two countries for almost 80 years, and during the life of which Russia had repeatedly proved herself to be a reliable friend of this country. The Jews wanted just two things from William Howard Taft: the abrogation of the Russian treaty and the veto of what Congress has repeatedly tried to do, namely put a literacy test on immigrants. Jewish immigration into the United States being so important an element of Jewish plans, American Jews have never cared what kind of human riffraff filled the country, as long as the Jewish flood was not hindered.
Can you just think about that? You know, in order to get their aims and get all their people in here, they didn't care who else came or what kind of, you know, what was being done to this country. And they're just the same now.
Yeah. Yeah, Jews are certainly in the forefront of promoting all kinds of immigration still.
Yeah.
President Taft had undergone the persistent nagging characteristic of such campaigns and had asked, perhaps impatiently, what they wanted him to do.
See, that's that thing. You see, they nag and they nag and they nag, and you can't tell them to go to hell, which you should be able to, but so finally you just can't take anymore. You say, well, what the heck do you want from me anyway? Well, then they told him.
Okay.
Unfortunately.
Have a conference with some of the leaders of American Jewry, was the proposal made to him. And on February 15th, 1911, there walked into the White House Jacob H. Schiff, Jacob Firth, Louis Marshall, Adolf Krauss, and Judge Henry M. Goldfogel. They had lunch with the president's family and adjourned to the library. The president was fairly wise in the matter. There was no chance whatever for him in an argument. His guests had come prepared to talk, to tell him, as some of the same men lately told an Eastern publisher, pounding the table and uttering threats. The president was to be overwhelmed, his good nature carried with a rush. But instead of anything like that, the president, as soon as they gathered in the library, took out a paper and began to read his conclusions. That staggered the Jewish ambassadors at once. The president was reading his conclusions. He was telling them. The president's statement is really worth reading, but it is far too lengthy to present here. He called attention to the right which this country exercised to say who shall and who shall not sojourn here, and also to the conflicting interpretations which American secretaries of state had given to the Russian treaty. He contrasted with that Russia's consistent interpretation from the beginning. He then said that the treaty was sacred because under it, for more than 50 years, the citizens of the United States had made their investments in Russia, resting solely on their faith in the United States and Russia's treaty honor. He said that if it were a new treaty that was being written, the case would be different. He would then consider the Jewish argument of weight, but, he said, we had other treaties with other countries who did not always share our views as to what certain sections of the treaties meant, but we have lived and worked under them. He instanced the Italian treaty with regard to the extradition of criminals. He wished to impress on the Jewish ambassadors that they wanted to make an exception of their case, which of course they did. The president then said he would be willing to consider taking some action if he did not believe that in taking action he would be endangering the status the Jews already enjoyed in Russia. If this treaty were denounced, large American interests would be jeopardized. Here the president mentioned certain interests, all Gentile. He said he liked to see Russian Jews come into the country, but added, the more we spread them out in the West, the better I like it. He ended with a plea for the Jewish ambassadors there present to consider the plight which denunciation of the treaty might involve Russian Jews, and ended with the words, that is the way it has struck me, gentlemen. That is the conclusion I have reached. The Jewish group was plainly taken aback. Simon Wolfe, who was always on guard at Washington, said, please, Mr. President, do not give to the press such conclusions. But Jacob H. Schiff broke in with a voice vibrant with anger. I want it published. I want the whole world to know the president's attitude. The discussion then opened, with the president cool and self-contained. Finally, after some useless talk, and having other business to attend to, he gave them a letter just received from the American ambassador at St. Petersburg, Mr. Rockhill. Mr. Rockhill presented in that letter to the president the whole Russian contention about the Jews, statements which have been confirmed 1,000 times by the events that have since occurred. Then they renewed their expostulations and arguments, but to no avail. The president expressed regret, but he said he could see no other course to pursue. He had studied the question in all its lights and his conclusion was as stated. On leaving the White House, Jacob Schiff refused to shake the president's hand, but brushed it by with an air of offended power.
"Wasn't Mr. Schiff angry yesterday?" exclaimed the president the next day. But the president did not know what was going on. When Jacob Schiff was descending the White House steps, he said, "This means war!" He gave orders to draw on him for a large sum of money. He wrote a curt letter to President Taft. The president sent Mr. Schiff's letter and the reply to the Secretary of Commerce and Labor, Charles Nagel, who replied to the president with these words, "I am very impressed with the patience which you exhibit in your answer." Neither did the president know what was behind it all. Look at most of the names of the men who represented American Jewry in the White House that 15th of February, 1911.
Yeah, and German. Yeah, just I think he means German names. If you look at all the names, they tended to be German names.
Okay. And then consider that the abrogation of the Russian treaty would throw all the vast business between the United States and Russia into Germany, into the hands of German Jews. The Frankfurt bankers and their relatives in the United States knew what that meant. It meant that German Jews would be the intermediaries of trade between Russia and the United States. The business itself meant money, but the relation meant power over Russia. And Jacob H. Schiff lived to overthrow Russia. The neutrality of the United States was torn to shreds by a movement organized and financed on American soil for the overthrow of a friendly nation, and the organizers and financiers were Jews. They used their internal power to deflect the policy of the United States to assist their plans.
See, now, this to say the neutrality of the United States was torn to shreds because of these Jews. That's what they wanted. And they're still doing that. We can't have any neutrality anymore. How long ago that was?
It's so obvious now.
Yeah. Right. And here's where you see an instance where they were pushing and they push and they push until they get what they want.
The game was financial and revolutionary. It was decreed. It was the then part of the program to be accomplished. And the United States was to be used as the crowbar to batter down the walls. When the Jewish ambassadors left the White House, orders flew from Washington and New York to every part of the United States, and the Jewish nagging drive began. It had a center in every city. It was focused on every representative and senator. No official, however, was too mean or unimportant to be drafted. American editors may remember that drive. It was operated on precisely the same lines as the one which is proceeding against the press today. The Jews have furnished absolute proof in the last 2 months that they control the majority of the American press. There are signs, however, that their control does not mean anything and will not last long.
Well, they were wrong there again, weren't they?
Yeah.
Still so hopeful that, you know, just like people are today, well, they're about ready to crash down where, you know, their power is too thin or the house of cards or something, you know, we're going to win any day now. Yeah, sure. People need to be a little more realistic.
Jacob Schiff had said on February 15th, "This means war." He had ordered a large sum of money used for that purpose. The American Jewish Committee, B'nai B'rith, and others of the numerous organizations of Jewry, how well organized they are, the signatories of the recent Jewish defense prove, went to work, and on December 13th of the same year, almost 10 months to a day after Jewry had declared war on President Taft's conclusions, both houses of Congress ordered President Taft to notify Russia that the treaty with Russia would be terminated.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, Hanning, isn't that just, I've got that in giant type because, you know, I just find that so amazing that they managed to do that, to get Congress to go against what President Taft wanted and to terminate this treaty with Russia. Just stupid. Just because the Jews pushed them. So even then, I guess they needed that Jewish money. They're afraid of the Jewish press going against their, you know, their reelection campaigns and so on. Terrible. It's just terrible. People need to be aware of these traitor, this kind of infamy that goes on, created by the Jews in this country.
Yeah,
they're certainly undermining every process, and certainly undermining the so-called democratic process. Anyway, I'm sorry. This just amazes me.
Yeah,
that happened.
Yeah, democracy.
An 80-year-old treaty that had been working fine, they got rid of it. Got Congress to terminate it, to vote to terminate it. Amazing. So, what were you going to say?
I said democracy is very vulnerable to organized pressure from particular interests.
Well, that's why the Jews push it, because they know it is, and they know how to misuse it, take advantage of it.
Yeah, Plato already described that back in the 4th century BC. He said that there were people that he called drones that would gather around the government and push their particular interests.
Yeah.
In the meantime, of course, well, I forgot this.
Yeah.
Frankfurt on the Main had won. In the meantime, of course, the Jewish press of the United States berated President Taft with characteristic Jewish unreserve. It would be an eye-opener if, at every speech which William Howard Taft makes for his Jewish clients, there could be distributed copies of the remarks printed about President Taft by those same clients 9 years ago. The methods by which the Jews set forth to force congressional action are all known. And the glee with which Jewry hailed the event is also known. Two governments had been beaten, the American and the Russian, and an American president had been reversed. Whether this had anything to do with the fact that William Howard Taft became that unusual figure, a one-term president, this chronicle does not undertake to say. There was quite a scurry for cover at that time. Taft had been beaten, and all the men who had stood beside him ran in out of the storm. John Hayes Hammond was represented as having been sympathetic with the Russian view of the Jews, as most of the American representatives were. As late as 1917, William Howard Taft, then a private citizen, wrote to the principal Jewish lobbyists at Washington asking that Mr. Hammond be not held up in Jewish histories as one of those who had opposed the breaking of the Russian treaty. The president had really done what he could to prevent the Jewish plan going through. On February 15, 1911, he withstood them face to face. On December 13, 1911, they had whipped him. And yet, in the next year, 1912, a peculiar thing occurred. The high officials of the B'nai B'rith went to the White House, and there, pinned on the breast of President Taft, a medal which marked him as the man who had contributed most during the year to the welfare of the Jewish cause.
You know, he should have refused that medal, but he didn't. I guess he felt he couldn't. These political strict structures are terrible. I wouldn't want to have a medal that said I contributed to the welfare of the Jewish cause. Why would anybody?
But it is kind of like a humiliating pat on the head.
It is. That's what it was. Well, I'll let you go on and read it.
There is a photograph extant of President Taft standing in the south on the south portico of the White House in the midst of a group of prominent Jews, and the president is wearing this medal. He is not smiling.
Yeah, I found that picture. I'm using it for the program page. And I cut out some of the Jews because it was too wide of a picture. But he definitely is not smiling. He's got this medal stuck on his chest. It's horrible. Horrible. Anyway.
But even after that, the Jews were not sure of President Taft. There was a fear expressed by private letters between prominent Jews and also in the Jewish press that President Taft, while officially abrogating the treaty, would consent to some working agreement which would amount to about the same thing. There were cables from Jews in Russia stating that Taft would do that. The president was closely watched. Whenever there was an open chink in his daily program, he was approached on the matter. It was made utterly impossible for him to do anything to patch up the differences. Frankfurt was to have the handling of American trade with Russia, and Jewry was to have that club over Russia. Money, more and more money, always accompanies every Jewish plan for racial or political power. They make the world pay them for subjugating it, and their first cinch hold on Russia they won in the United States. The end of that American influence was the rise of Bolshevism, the destruction of Russia, and the murder of Nicholas Romanov and his family. That is the story of William Howard Taft's efforts to withstand the Jews, and how they broke him. It is probably worth knowing in view of the fact that he has become one of those Gentile fronts which the Jews use for their own defense.
Well, we did finish it. That's the end of the chapter. I guess it wasn't as long as I thought, so I wasted all those words in the beginning. So we will go on to chapter 39 next week, which is looks very interesting. I haven't read it, but this was January 15th, 1921, and I wanted to ask, what was that question I had? I have this. Frankfurt was to have the handling of American trade with Russia. How does that work? How would Frankfurt, Germany, have the handling of American trade? Does it mean the bankers in Frankfurt? Because, I mean, what took place here that somehow the United States couldn't deal directly with Russia because they killed the treaty, and so they had to deal through Germany, right?
I don't know exactly how this works, you know, but Frankfurt on Main was and still is a major banking center.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that's where Rothschild was set up in Germany.
Yeah. Yeah, and so somehow they got all that business for themselves, and they weren't, you know, didn't have to be that friendly with Russia, or, you know, I mean, they got everything they wanted behind the scenes. And this shows what kind of a terrible, terrible, ruthless enemy these people are. There's no way that anybody should argue that they need to be treated fairly. I'll let you have the last word.
I think it's less humiliating. It would have been less humiliating for Taft to come out against the Jews rather than to accept that medal, have his picture taken, and he would have accomplished some good.
Well, I agree, but I imagine his advisors maybe told him otherwise, or maybe he thought, I don't know, but that's what we have. Every one of our politicians, I don't care how promising they appear, they end up caving into these people. So these people have something.
There seems to be an ethos of getting along by going along that you have to function in this kind of electoral politics.
Well, but you know, they did this to Taft, and then at this time, then later they did it to Ford. So, well, we can talk about that next week. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks again for listening.
Rage, rage, I'm breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.